spending large sums of money in various fields, training fields, and so forth. But by golly, one of the largest employers in Canada is D&D, and no effort is being made to either sell D&D or the reserves as a means of taking up the slack in the unemployment situation or helping people and training and what have you. And it's an area that I feel deserves much more attention. But that's today, and that should be on that.
You were also, you came back at a time in 69, of course, when the, shall we say, the youth throughout North America and elsewhere was in revolt. This is the epitome of the time when you had the hippies, the
very true.
The whole schmear.
Very true.
When the military was at its nadir insofar as being attractive, mm-hmm. You came back a year after they'd cut out the COTC from the universities. Mm-hmm. I remember in 69 when I was running this military program here, you'd get a general, I'd invite a general to speak, or a commander, or a captain. And one of the first things they'd ask me was, should I wear my uniform when I speak to the class,
sort of thing.
So this was not a good time, by any matter of means, and yet perhaps it was also a time when one shouldn't be cutting down the military. Yeah. And this would be, again, something over which you would have no control.
Okay.
But it was feared when Mr. Trudeau was really applying,
that is right,
the cuts to the military.
Very much so. Not so much cuts at that time, it was the frozen budget. This was
the
beginning of the frozen budget.
Right.
With inflation hitting us at about, say, 9-10% per annum, which basically meant a reduction of 10% per annum.
Boy,
we went through 3 years of that, and that at the end of 3 years...
Yeah.
Hurting was not the word for it. We were quietly withering on the vine.
Yeah.
And I'm still not too sure that the damage is done during that period was so severe. I sometimes wonder if we'll ever really recover. It'll take a long time before.
A long time.
But again, we're on to now sort of the future rather than what was going on in those days.
But nevertheless, Reg, you'd be faced with a very practical problem of, shall we say, being in a situation where Canada, and I'm thinking now of the Army, where Canada has a NATO force in Europe, you're in charge of the immediate backup, and then behind the backup you have this reserve with a big question mark behind it. And now, mind you, my experience, well, like yours, is Second World War. And my memory goes back to the time when the war started, we had 3,500 regular soldiers, yet we ended up with an army of about 600,000. Now, those people, you know, the initial group were the reserves. You depended upon the militia. One thinks in terms of 1939, when we had a militia or a reserve of about 51 or 52,000 people. And you're talking about a paper figure of about 19,000 and a real figure of maybe 15 or 16,000. Well, now, you know, if the balloon did go up, what in the name of God would you have done?
Oh, yes, and I think even to add to what you have said was that the turnover in the reserves is enormous.
Yeah.
They turn over about more than 50% per annum, one questions the quality of the, not just quantities, but the quality of the reserves that we have today. It's questionable just how effective they would be at the moment, because they have not had the equipment to train on, and people get bored, and so they leave. We need to revitalize the reserves. There's no question about that at all.
Can I ask you another question? Was it during your period when the reserves began to train seriously with the regular forces, or did that
come later? Yes, they did. No, that was another one of the
I think that's a good idea.
It came about not because of the reserves. You know, it didn't come about because we thought the reserves should do that kind of training.
Mm.
That came about because the regular force was hurting so badly, and had been cut. And so many slots, and particularly in Europe, so many slots had been chopped out of the establishment that that the effective fighting capability of some of the units was questionable. They had to have additional people. And so every time there was an exercise, and in Europe, most of the exercises are held during the summer months. So it was a question of finding people from the reserves who could go and flush out the regular force establishment and fill the slots that had had to be dropped as a result of reductions that took place. And so, and it was, that was the way it came about. And it was, no one knew whether it would work or not. A call went out to the reserves. Would anybody be interested in going and spending a month or 6 weeks in England, Europe, working with one of the regular force units? And by God, it worked. There were a number who came forward and said, yes, we would like to do that. And it worked so well that the Air Force did the same thing. In those days, we had what would be UNAF, or maybe it was before, that the Air Force had done the same thing by saying to the auxiliary reserves, the Air Force reserves, any pilots interested in going and spending a few months out in the Middle East flying the same type of airplane, otters, and that had been flying before. And there were a number who said, yes, damn right, I'd like to get that additional flying experience. And so they went and spent 6 months or so forth. And they were up to standard. They had passed the various exams and tests, and they had their instrument rating and all this sort of thing. They were fully qualified pilots, and they worked well. So it worked, and because a regular needed these people. Now, of course, the other side comes into play, the effect this had on the reserves, because it all of a sudden it was realized that this was not only good training, but it was a type of thing that was needed to give several of the reservists that Philippe, then keep them in.
Yeah.
And make it attractive.
Yeah.
I only wish it was possible to do it on a grander scale, but it has its limitations. They're obvious. One, of course, is the cost, the money that's required, because these have got to be paid out of some kind of fund. There's no money in the normal establishment to cover that position, because it ain't there.
Yeah.
It's there on a paper wartime mobilization, the establishment, but not a peacetime one. Secondly, the availability. Sometimes these people just aren't available. They're either university students who are trying to find a job to pay for their summer training and their next year's course, whatever it might be. And also the level of their training. To take a lad and say put him into a recce unit or something, or an artillery unit in the brigade group in England, in Europe, and he's got to fit right into a slot immediately with the team. Yeah. Well, you've got to have somebody who's reasonably well trained. You can't just take him off the street and slap him into that operation unit, because he's going to go right into an exercise almost as soon as he gets there.
Yeah.
So there isn't going to be time to train him. He's got to be up to a reasonable standard. So that has its limitations as well. But nevertheless, notwithstanding those shortcomings, it still is an effective and good thing. And I do wish we could do more of that. But it was that flushing out, again, that one of the roles of the reserves, and one of the things, and again, that study I mentioned about, was just that. How many of the reservists would be up to a standard to go and flush out our operational units? Not only the ones in Europe, but the ones that were going to go, the ones that would go up to the northern flank, the ones that would be left in Canada as the immediate reserve, because obviously if a shooting war starts, the attrition is going to be very, very heavy, and we're going to need a flow of reinforcements immediately.
Yeah.
Where are they going to come from?
Right.
And then finally, in relation to the reserve, you have the business of a cadre for training. We'd obviously have mobilization of one form or another. You'd have to have people who would then become the core for training.
Yeah.
So there was ample requirement. There are all kinds of requirements for the reserves to fill and do a job. It's a question of getting them in now, having the equipment to train them, and keeping them. Keeping them is the important thing.
I think another thing, too, that has come up, well, maybe I'm being old-fashioned here, but one of the things, traditionally at least, that is... kept a militiaman with his regiment has been a great deal of the, what we call a regimental tradition, regimental pride and all that sort of thing, without a doubt.
Yeah, yeah.
Whether they're tweedling flutes or playing the pipes, this is their regiment, their hometown, their traditions, their battle honors and whatnot.
Yep.
And yet, this was a period, again, when you were there, when the Jolly Green Giants were coming in, the unification.
That's right.
Did you get any blowtorch from this constant move towards green, green, green for everybody?
Oh, hell yes. It was grim. Every regiment fought it tooth and nail right down the line. And the Mobile Command, there was little that Mobile Command could do. The policy was established, and we were given the policy. It was a question of implementing it. We could shoot back up the line the complaints and so forth, but the policy was established. It was a ministerial directive, and it was a question of getting on with it. But those people then, instead of coming up through Mobile Command, they started to go up through CDA, and that was where, through the defense associations, that you got things like, yes, okay, the kilts. The Scottish regiments will retain the kilt. Where the question of buttons, regimental buttons, would be retained. So gradually there was a hacking, not a hacking way, modification, if you will, in a very minor way, with exception of the kilt, in a very minor way, of the policy of unification and the common uniform. That then, of course, succeeding ministers have made changes since then. Regimental mess kits are back in, whereas before it was the green or the dark blue mess kit. So there has been a bit of a slipping back from the hard position that was taken right from the very first days of unification. How far back we're going to slide, I don't know. Obviously, we can't go too far. It's awfully difficult to unscramble an egg. This is what it would require. And logistically and administratively, of course, there's no two ways about it. If we had not been unified, I think the armed forces of Canada would have gone right back to where they were before World War II. We would have had minuscule armed forces, because we would have all had the same logistics system, we would have all had the same number of headquarters, or we would have had to do away with headquarters. We couldn't have operated with that kind of manpower requirement. And as a result of unification, and perhaps the bringing together of all the logistics support in the administration, it undoubtedly saved thousands of positions, which made it possible to keep the armed forces at least at the level they were, even if they didn't have modern equipment. For example, we did, I guess it would be about that time that when the final decision was taken on the amalgamation of the depots. All kinds of supply depots. Now let's just take supply depots. There were some 11 supply depots in the armed forces. And after unification and the study, they were reduced to 4 depots. And those 4 depots managed to cope nicely, thank you, with the requirement. So it was possible to close down 7 depots, and that was a lot of positions. Similarly with repair depots, it was possible to do a lot of amalgamating as well, which helped. Not as effective there, because the repair depots, you start to get into the special equipment, and you have to have those special skills and techniques. But nevertheless, economies were able to be, particularly when you've got to overhauling a vehicle. What the hell is the difference between a vehicle? I'm not talking necessarily only about a military pattern vehicle, but a vehicle that the Air Force might use could just as easily be overhauled in a depot that was, as a matter of fact, probably better. Yeah. That's right. By the depots that had been set up by the Army to do just that. So, I am convinced that the unification coming just before the freeze on budget, the cuts that had taken place, the reduction, trying to cut the expenditures on defense, that if we had not had unification, we would have gone right back to very, very small forces. The Air Force, I don't see how the Air Force would have been able to manage with out the savings that were accrued through reductions in the administration, cutting out headquarters, and the depots, all the logistics support behind it.
I've heard it said, too, Reg, that if we hadn't had the FLQ crisis, the armed forces would just be a bunch of Boy Scouts.
Oh, yes. The politically, the FLQ crisis couldn't have come along at a better time for the armed forces.
Yeah. Now, you'd be involved in that right up
yes,
to your teeth.
You absolutely, know. Yeah. And that, of course, that's in my time at Mobile Command, was the big thing that happened during that time period. And perhaps the next session I might just cover that one.
A separate.
But just to wrap up, I guess to wrap up the rest, there were a lot of exercises in the Arctic. I did, by God, learn to appreciate the infantryman. I can tell you that. I remember one occasion I came out to watch an exercise out here on the coast, as a matter of fact. The PPCLI were up at near Renfrew. And it was in the fall, and it was wet. Oh, jeez, it was pouring with rain. And I drove up to see them, and all I could see was just the commander and his command post and a few troops around, and I said, where the hell is everybody? And they're all out there. Well, out there was one of those very bad logged-off wilderness areas, logged off many, many years ago, where and burned off, where the undergrowth had come back, but all those, what today would be recovered, those large logs were still lying helter-skelter, one on top of the other. Today they would have, it's a sort of situation that wouldn't, the government doesn't allow to happen with land today, but it did then. And I said to the commander, I said, well, what's happening? He said, well, we started over, and he had his map, and there was a logging road, and it was about 2 miles away, and he said, at midnight last night, the battalion started on a line along that road, and between them and, you know, it was just them, I don't forget what time it was about 10 o'clock, but they were supposed to have been on this road at 8 o'clock this morning, and God, there was no one to be seen. And I said, you mean they had to come through that over that land, through that terrain, pitch black night, pouring rain, and give them just, and it was about 2 miles, and do that in that kind of time? He said, oh, you sure? I said, I think you're nuts. I wouldn't have gone 50 yards into that damn bush, let alone try and travel 2 miles in pitch black night and keep some kind of contact. Oh, God. And they had had only one broken leg. That was the only casualty they had. A lad spent trying to go over one of these logs in pitch black. And I'm like, you'd have to have seen that terrain to really appreciate the difficulty in trying to travel 2 miles with it. To me, it was impossible.
Do you remember the name of the CO?
I think it was Warsaw. Marsaw, something like that. Marsaw, I think it was. And, but I had other occasions. Again, going back to our transport command, I don't think I've told this little story of, the commander then of Quebec Command, he wanted to do an exercise up around Chimo, up at Ungava. And he said, would you come along and do a recce with me to pick a spot for an airdrop? This was an airborne exercise. And that's why I went along. I said, sure. Well, we went up, and he picked a spot that was on the edge of a lake, and there were boulders that you wouldn't believe, sort of 6 feet high, 5 feet high. The area was just as if someone had taken a whole pile of marbles or peas and scattered them all over the ground. And he said, well, now that's going to be the drop zone. And I said, you're not going to put troops down on that terrain, are you? And I said, you know, God, they'll have broken legs. You'll have a hell of a lot of casualties. And he said, oh, yes. He said, hell, it's the Van Dues I'm going to do this. And he said, hell, I'll drop them here, and then we'll have casualties, sure, but we'll have good pickup, and we'll have choppers to take them in. And he said, and after that, they'll come back and ask me why the hell I didn't give them a tough drop zone. You know? And I thought, well, it was difficult. As I say, I developed a great deal of respect for the infantryman, and I use the infantryman because I watched several of the regiments operating, whether it was in the north,
yeah,
the Arctic. Some of those drops that we did with the combined exercises out of Alaska, when the ground temperature was minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit, and here we were dropping people from airplanes into that kind of a climate temperature,
yeah,
where 90-95% of their effort once they got on the ground was just surviving. And we had one troop, they were separated from their pallets with all their survival gear on it, and it was touch and go whether we were going to lose about 25 men. They were in dire straits, and fortunately it was picked up by them in the control, and they managed to get some survival gear to them quickly. But they were there in 60 below zero weather with nothing. No rations, nothing. It was all on the pallet, and what had happened was that the chutes had streamed, and the pallet just went straight in, and of course they were coming down in their own parachute, and they were a long, long, long way away. Well, they didn't know where the hell their pallet was. And there was no way of finding it.
Probably still up there.
Probably still
well
there.
Preserved.
That's right, still there, yep.
Yeah.
But again, those were the sort of things that made me realize just what to... And then another lovely story about those things up north of the lads trying to constipate themselves to the point where in that climate they wouldn't have to have a bowel movement for 7 days. It's just too damn cold. So anyway, but. It was a revelation for me. I mentioned the infantry. Of course, the other units were all doing the same sort of thing, but they just didn't seem to be didn't have as tough a job to do as those infantrymen.
Yeah.
And that, it was a great experience for me, an understanding of how they operate. But it was a routine type of thing, the usual crises of getting ready for exercises, of shortage of money, of trying to prepare a budget and then hone the budget down to what we knew we were likely to get and what was going to be chopped and where were the priorities and what I would call routine type of command. And then the real, we had small crises, the odd assistance with the penitentiaries, if you'll recall. During that time period, we had the odd penitentiary problem, and the troops, we provided small numbers to move in and provide support to the staff in the penitentiaries. Kingston was a case in point. I went into Kingston, as a matter of fact, after one of the riots there, and by God, I just didn't believe what rioting people could do, supposedly with nothing.
Yeah.
How the hell they got doors off, wrenched doors off, doors that were literally steel and hinged, and how the hell they got them off, the way they managed to break up the furniture, the small amount of furniture they had, where the water all came from, unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was chaotic. It was an absolute shambles. I went in while the hardcore were still in one part of the prison and had not come out, and they were still being defiant and threatening anybody who came near them. So it would be sort of the day after the riot kind of when I went in. But again, it was a case of the troops being spread around, and in case anybody had a firearm, and if anybody did start to make a break, and there were orders to shoot if they had to back up the guards, the staff.
Yeah.
But there were several incidents like that, but they were of relatively short duration and of no real major impact on the command. But the FLQ crisis was a horse of a different story, and that I think we can come to next. Oh, just interesting that it should be right at this time. Here we are today, yesterday, with another one of the FLQ supporters returning to Canada, and as we had Langto and the others have just returned after all these years, here they are finally coming back to Canada. I would have had them and put them against the wall at that time.
I'll bet.
But that's another story, and we'll pick that one up, I think, perhaps next time.
Okay.